Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, of course, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. And I am having a great conversation with Maggie Anton, who I interviewed last year about her books, the series of books on Rashi's daughters. We just came out with a new book called 50 Shades of Talmud. So you guys can guess what that's all about. Maggie, thank you so much for joining me from Arizona, no less.
Yes, it is my, I would like to say it's my pleasure, except it was 105 degrees here today.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so I'm glad you're inside for this interview. I'm glad we brought you inside. So that is quite a title, 50 Shades of Talmud. You're an expert on the Talmud and an author. So how do you combine all this? And this book is a little, I don't know, is it risque? I mean, it's the Talmud. Normally people don't associate the Talmud with sex, right? So how did you put all this together? Is it a novel?
No, actually, 50 Shades of Talmud, and the subtitle is what the first rabbis had to say about you know what.
Right.
And it is a short, as you know, nonfiction work. And this interrupted my novel journey. I actually have another novel that I had started working on, but I was speaking about my last series of novels. And as happens when I'm speaking to Hadassah or some of the all women's groups, then I get into some of the sexy stuff in the Talmud, of which there is a lot. And the women were enjoying it and they're laughing and everything. And one of the women raises her hands and says, oh, you should write 50 Shades of Talmud. Everybody laughed. And in the car, way back, I thought, I could do that.
You could.
I could really do that. And I thought, I'll find 50 sugya sections of Talmud that have to do with sex, and I'll put them into, you know, modern English and comment on them. And my concern was mainly that I wouldn't be able to find 50, but it turned out when I went back to my notes, because I keep track, I keep notes on all the Talmud that I've studied. I know what daf it is and what's in there. And actually, if someone emails me, MaggieAnton@gmail.com, and they want to see my 44 pages, single spaced, indexed to Talmud that I've studied. It's not your usual piece. It's not what they teach in yeshiva, that's for sure.
Right.
So I thought this would be easy. I'll just look at my notes. And I found like 87 sections. So then it was a matter of cutting it down to like the top 50.
Right.
And I put it together. And then when I showed it to my daughter, who is my best and worst critic, because she's not embarrassed or ashamed to say, Mom, this is really bad.
That's the best critic. This. Yes.
You know,
exactly. And she's an honest critic. Right.
Honest critic. Exactly. Good. My editors, they're all, you know, they don't want to hurt my feelings.
Right. Yeah. Our daughters seem to have no compunction about doing that.
No.
So good
no.
for
and
you.
I appreciate that.
Yes.
In terms, she's the only one who sees my first drafts, the only one I trust on that.
Beautiful.
And she said, this is still too scholarly. I know you want to make this like lighthearted. You want to make it for a general audience, but it's too scholarly. And she suggested, you know, you should put in some kind of jokes and quotes and stuff like that from Jewish. There's a lot of Jewish comedians and pithy, you know, people make pithy sayings. And she made a few suggestions. And I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. So that was actually the research that I had to do for 50 Shades of Talmud. I already had all the Talmud. I had to find the pithy sayings. So I started looking through like the big book of Jewish jokes, and I you know, did a lot of internet searches and came up with 50. And then my editor said, this is really great. We need more. We want one for like every paragraph, not every just 50.
Right.
And it was actually, it was the most fun. It was also very difficult to find a quote that exactly matched the sugya that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, there's sections on marriage, of course, because for Judaism, sex and marriage go together.
Right.
And I found a quote from Socrates that said, by all means, marry. If you find a good wife, you'll be happy. If you find a bad wife, you'll become a philosopher.
Saying a reflection possibly on his own life. Yes,
exactly. So this is particularly appropriate from Socrates as opposed to, you know,
the Jewish sources. Right.
Yes. And of course I have quotes from Woody Allen and Amy Schumer and, famous Jewish comedians, and they have a lot to say on it. But other quotes, I have a great quote at the beginning from George Washington about the Garden of Eden. Once a man has tasted the forbidden fruit, he will never be able. I can't quote it exactly. I don't have the book in front of me. I'm
Right.
kind of embarrassed I didn't bring it. I meant to bring it to Arizona, but I didn't. But you have the
I
quote.
have it. You know the page?
Oh, it's the very first, it's the very first quote in the first chapter.
Okay. I'm flipping through. So let me ask you
Please.
something, Maggie, because I've got a feeling that some of my listeners are now are maybe squirming a little in their chairs or a little uncomfortable because, this is a conservative station and this is maybe something that people are saying like sex, Talmud, rabbis, that all goes in the same sentence. So
Yes, we should go back to the
why are we
beginning.
uncomfortable? I'm going to like actually go to the end of my thought here, which is why should we be uncomfortable with this? I mean, the Talmud was written 1600 years ago in societies where they're less conservative than we are. What has happened in the last millennia and a half to make it so that this kind of discussion about marriage, about sex and marriage, about what the rabbi said about sex and about human beings should make us feel like it belongs on, I don't know, maybe Howard Stern, but not on Rejuvenation with Eve Harrow. What are your thoughts on
Well,
that?
you got to remember the, I mean, for Jews, Christians, anybody for whom the Bible is our holy text, as far as the rabbis were concerned, the very first commandment, chronologically, is be fruitful and multiply. And of
Yeah.
course, back in those days, and for pretty much all of human history, in order to be fruitful and multiply, you had to have sex. So the rabbis, on one hand, had a commandment that you have to have sex. But on the other hand, there were all these times and places and people with whom you should not have sex. So you have the to do, you have, yes, you must have sex, but also plenty of thou shall nots about sex.
Right.
These being the rabbis, they had to, first of all, they had to define what does it mean actually to have sex, which, as you, I do get, they get into that in quite detail. But I think what has happened, particularly when Christianity started focusing that celibacy was the ideal, their focus changed to the thou shalt nots. And the Jewish focus, perhaps at least in Talmudic times, when the Christians were Rome and they were the bad guys as far as the Jews in Israel and Babylonia were concerned, focused on the thou shalt procreate. Because there's another part of the Bible that says, you shall not diminish your wife's food, her clothing. And the Hebrew word is ona'ah, which usually in English translation, it's your conjugal obligation. And the rabbis said, this is providing sexual satisfaction to your wife. The husband can have as many wives as he wants. He can go to prostitutes. He is not restricted like a wife. If she has sex with any other man, she is committing adultery. So she's quite limited, and the rabbis felt it was the husband's responsibility to make sure that she is satisfied
To keep
because
her
he has other
happy.
options she doesn't. So they focused also on how do you do that and what does it mean? And I think for certainly for the Christians and the other society that came later, that focus seems to have dropped off or disappeared, and people looked more and more at the what I call the thou shalt nots, when you're not supposed to and how you're not supposed to.
So what you're saying is that the context under which the Talmud was written, which is always important, it's what I tell people
Yes,
over and over,
absolutely.
the most important text is context. And so when we're reading this, which as you say is written in a time period when the Roman Empire was quite strong, and then it part of it anyway goes into Christianity, and there's a different focus. But the Jews in Babylon in particular, so the Jews in the land of Israel are under Rome and later under the Byzantine Empire. You can see why that focus would change. But specifically the Jews in Babylon, because there's two Talmuds, right? There's the
Right.
Jerusalem Talmud written in the land of Israel. There's the Babylonian Talmud written by the rabbis in Babylon, where we had gone during the first exile when the first temple is
Yes.
destroyed and some people hadn't come back. So what is the context of where they're writing the Babylonian Talmud
Okay,
at
the
the time.
Babylonians are writing, they're living under the Persians, who are Zoroastrians, and they've been under the Persians for 1,000 years since, I mean, they've been living in Babylonia for 1,000 years. They've been
Right.
under the Persians for only like a few hundred years.
Which is nothing in Jewish
Yeah, it
history.
was nothing
A
in Jewish
couple hundred
history.
years here and there. Right.
And the Persians were all, they're monotheists, the Zoroastrians, and they also have a very sex positive view. They are also commanded to procreate. So again, they are commanded to have sex. They have some of the same restrictions that the Jews do, not during a woman's period. And so that there's some of the same restrictions, but it's very also sex positive by the Zoroastrians in Persia and Babylonia. So the Jews are living under that culture, and they are taking in their cultural society views that, around them. And again, the Persians are at war with Rome. So the Persians, the Zoroastrians, are the enemies of the Roman Christians and the enemies of my friends. The Jews and Persians got along very well and have many, I was quite surprised in studying this to find out how similar the Zoroastrian views are, as well as the Judaism as in the Torah, because they both at the same time. But the rabbis, believe me, when they're creating Talmud, but they don't realize they're creating Talmud. They're just discussing the Mishnah. They're trying to figure out what is Jewish law, because the Jews have their own courts in Babylonia. They live under their own king, the exilarch, who's a vassal of the Persian king, yes, but they have their own courts, their own bureaucracy. And the rabbis are the scribes, or if they're really good, the judges. So the Talmud is the rabbis who are the judges and the teachers teaching the young men, their students, who will eventually also become scribes and judges. So they have to know what's Jewish law. So if the Talmud says you're not allowed to commit adultery, the rabbis have to say, well, what act is it that is adultery? What do you actually have to do? That, it's not like, oh, we all think we know, but actually we don't. People have very different ideas about what is adultery. And so the rabbis had to define it, and they had to define then, okay, what exactly is sex? And as I say in the book, the way the rabbis describe it, Bill Clinton did not have sex with that woman, because that stuff is not what the rabbis consider sex. It is not procreative. It does not, lead to children. So they have a different view of it.
So what did they feel, for example, about homosexuality? Because that comes up a lot these days. As is that really in the Bible, is that considered like just a terrible thing? That's a big, big issue these days, both in the Jewish and Christian world.
It wasn't then.
It
The
wasn't.
Bible has a few things to say about homosexuality. I actually have that wonderful quote. The God has 360 something admonitions to heterosexuals in the Bible, and six admonitions to homosexuals. And it's not that God loves heterosexuals less, just that they need more supervision.
Yeah, it's got it. Page 65. I'm looking at it right now.
And so the rabbis also saw that most of the admonitions about sexual behavior were directed towards heterosexuals. They didn't discuss homosexuality very often. Matter of fact, as far as the Talmud is concerned, lesbians are, what they're doing is not sex. It's not, they, the rabbis do not prohibit it. And they do not consider a woman who's having a lesbian relationship with another woman, and either of them are married, they're not committing adultery. That's, adultery is only a married woman with another man. And they just say, it's like fooling around. It's not a sin. There's no sin offering for it. There's no punishment for it. They don't approve of it. But on the other hand, they don't consider it like worth their time to discuss. They mentioned lesbians like once or twice.
But how does
And
that jive, excuse me, with the family unit. The importance, really, Judaism is really about family. And you could say that Shabbat is to get together with your family. The entire Bible from the first family, dysfunctional as it might have been, but the entire, you know, all our matriarchs and patriarchs, it's all a family unit. And that is definitely the theme of the Bible and of Judaism, is create a family. Just as you said, the first commandment is to procreate, to have children. So a homosexual relationship wouldn't be able to do that. So do you think the rabbis of the Talmud, given today, where you now have this situation where homosexual relationships can still have, you know, have in vitro or all kinds of, you know, surrogacy. What do you think? Let's like imagine for a second. Would they have said that would be okay?
The rabbis assumed that they didn't see that there was such a thing as homosexuality. Mm-hmm. Remember the Romans were bisexual. They thought that, you know,
big deal. Anything goes, whatever. Right.
And the assumption was if women are doing these things, lesbians would have still been married to men. They still would have been having children. So what, and the husbands had more than one wife. So for all I know, the two, four, or however many wives the guy had, maybe the wives are, who don't, you know,
going
enjoying
out
each
for
other.
Coffee. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, the idea that two women would get married to each other was not something. They actually mentioned that there was a place in Egypt where women married women and men married men, and they disapproved of that because mm-hmm. that would not lead to procreation. Right. But they, of course, nowadays, as you know, there's nothing to, you know,
gotten around that, right?
Men and women married women, they have children,
right?
So the assumption was that men were married to women, and while they might do whatever they're going to do with men, the rabbis disapproved. But there's a place in the Talmud where they say that there's a Mishnah that says two bachelors should not sleep naked together under the same blanket, and they don't say why, but we're supposed to assume.
Right, infer, that. Right.
And then the sages then say, no, that's not the law. That's not the halakha. We do not suspect Jewish, and I'm trying to do a direct translation. We do not suspect Jewish men of mishkav zachar, of men having sex with mm-hmm. each other. And of course, like, what do they mean? We don't suspect. Is this like, don't ask, don't tell? They also, there's a place in the Talmud where a rabbi comes across his two of his students who are having sex with each other. And he admonishes them and they say, we are two and you are one. So you have to have two witnesses to have it. So that they could be saying, well, you're only yourself. You don't have another witness to say that you saw us doing this. And we are two who cannot testify against each other. A person cannot testify to their own sinfulness. I mean, in U.S. law, you know, you can't self-incriminate, and in the Talmud also. So the rabbi kind of throws up his hands and says, and realizes he can do nothing to punish these two men, other than it's clear he doesn't approve of what they're doing. But as much as the Torah may say they're supposed to be stoned or whatever's supposed to be happened, nothing happens because you're only the fact that when you come across two men, there's going to be two of them. They cannot testify against each other. You would have to have more witnesses to counteract them. And what are the odds that you're going to have several people catch anybody mm-hmm. in the act? That's why it's also difficult to prove adultery. And then, of course, in the entire Talmud, nobody is ever stoned to death or punished in any way for adultery. Nobody is ever stoned to death or punished in any way, men, for having sex with each other. And believe me, the rabbis have, the whole Talmud is full of legal cases of other kinds of stuff. But these cases are never detailed. And I think they were saying, we don't suspect. We're not going to suspect. We're not going to look into, we don't want anyone to even think about what two men are doing. We don't mm-hmm. want you suspecting, imagining, thinking about this.
Well, that's why it's so important that the Mishnah and the Talmud, which as you said, is the commentary on the Mishnah being the oral law. that according to Judaism, along with the Torah being handed down at Sinai, comes the oral law, like the understanding. You know, the Bible is very, very laconic. Gives you a sentence without a whole lot of explanation. And that the oral law, which is handed down and eventually written down, because a lot of the rabbis who knew it were being killed by the Romans, and therefore it had to be put down, otherwise we would have lost it completely, is kind of explaining what the Bible would have meant. And that's why it's so important, and this is what Judaism does, to say, one second, don't just take that sentence. You could also say an eye for an eye, right? If some, like, there's a lot of things in the Bible that perhaps aren't meant literally. And what Judaism does is work it into real people. That's what I love about Judaism, is it works with people, not against us. So like sex, for example, you're not supposed to be celibate in Judaism. Absolutely. You're supposed to, but within the framework of marriage, which is called kiddushin, it's called holy. That's what's been translated as holy matrimony, meaning what we do is bring God into the world by being people, but doing things in such a way that reflects on God, and doing things in such a way that we don't just like let it go and do whatever we feel like doing. We drink wine too, but we make kiddush. You know, we bless the wine in a certain way. It's a religion made for people. And the Talmud in the book that you have, it's such a great book, 50 Shades of Talmud, you know, by Maggie Anton, is just like, this is us, lusty, physical, deal with it.
And God created us, the rabbis are very clear, God created us with two yetzers, the yetzer hatov, the good impulse,
inclination, right?
Inclination, the yetzer hara, what they call the evil inclination. Except the commentary, because they noticed that the word yotze is spelled with two yods, and they wonder why did God doesn't misspell stuff in the Torah.
Right.
So that's how they come up with the two yetzers. And then they say, but what the yetzer hatov, the good inclination, is good. The yetzer hara, the evil inclination, is very good. Because that's what it says in the, you know, when in creation, these certain things are very good. And the rabbis go, how can the evil inclination be very good? And the Talmud is very clear. Without the evil inclination, a man would not marry, would not have children, would not build a home, would not do business. People would just kind of lay around doing nothing. But the rabbis realize also this evil inclination, the yetzer hara, can get you into all kinds of trouble. And they consider that Torah study is the antidote for this. Men need to control their yetzer hara. They admit women also have a yetzer hara, but men's are stronger. And the rabbis are very realistic. There's three places in the Talmud where the rabbis say, if your evil inclination is too strong, if you see it is going to overpower you, you put on a black cloak, you go to a town where nobody knows who you are, and you do what your heart desires. You just do not desecrate God's name publicly. They understand we're human beings. Not everybody can be a holy person all the time. Even our great rabbis, they tell stories like Rabbi Akiva, especially the rabbis who protest too much how pious they are. So apparently Rabbi Akiva was one of those guys, and Satan appears to him as a beautiful woman on the top of a really, really tall palm tree. And Rabbi Akiva really forgets everything else, and he immediately starts climbing up this tall palm tree to get to this beautiful woman up there. And then, of course, once he gets nearly to the top, Satan reveals himself and leaves Rabbi Akiva stuck at the top of the palm tree, very embarrassed, of course. And anybody who's ever climbed a tree know that it's actually a lot more difficult to get down than up, especially a palm tree where the branches are pointing, you know.
And spiky, yeah, exactly. Spiky.
So Rabbi Akiva obviously comes down from the palm tree, but we have these examples, and they give like 400 rabbis who are too pious, and their yotzer hara overtakes them to their embarrassment, because you're not supposed to talk about how pious you are.
Right. Me doth protest too much. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. That's English, right, that works better. And so the rabbis are very aware this is a powerful urge that God has given us. And some of them wonder, one of the things I talk about, why did God give us this commandment to procreate? Like, wouldn't men have sex anyway? Why would God have to encourage men to have sex? Yet in the Torah, and certainly the way the rabbis interpreted it in the Talmud, they do encourage. I guess perhaps they're also aware that Christianity is pushing towards celibacy. that they're, that Christianity is pushing towards the true holiness is in monasticism. And there must have been rabbis who were tempted or inclined that way. We can be truly holy if I don't, but I have to worry about my family and my kids and all this stuff. Why? And God commands Jewish men, you must marry, you must have a family. You do not go to a monastery and shut yourself off from the rest of the people. And that's part, and having sex is part of that. You can't just push down that strong impulse that God has created in you. You have to find a way to, ideally, you make it holy in marriage and kiddushin. And if you're not perfect and you need to, you know, do what you got to do, then the rabbis accept that, but do it, don't flaunt it.
Are there any women quoted? I know that there are no women rabbis, as far as I know, right? Quoted in the Talmud. Right. There are no women.
Learned, yes.
Do you think it might have been a different conversation had there been women in there? I mean, I find it fascinating that it took a woman to write this book. This is, you know, what you did is you called sources that have been existing for, you know, 15, 16, 1800 years. It's not that you know, you didn't write the book. You just picked out and put it together. I find it fascinating that it took a woman to do that.
Yeah, and I want to make it very clear, I didn't make up any of the Talmud, and the sources, the actual sukkiot at the very back, I tell you what page, what daf each of these came from, so people can look it up and see it themselves.
Right, you didn't make anything up. So why do you think that it took a woman to do this?
Well, they certainly don't teach these particular passages in a rabbinic school. I've known enough rabbis to know that what I've written about is news to them. Very few people study the entire Talmud. And even the people who do Daf Yomi, you know, they're doing one Daf.
The daily page
of study. And this is very dense material, and they go over it very quickly. And I did Daf Yomi for a little while, and I actually did it on Tractate Nidah. And the rabbis...
on this topic, yes.
They skipped over the sex parts because they had a whole lot to do. They couldn't do the whole stuff. And so I realized, like, this is really not well studied. Certainly, and parts that I think really need to be studied, the rabbis are adamant that a woman must consent before a man can have sex with her. Silence is not consent. A wife is not assumed to consent. She must say yes, indicate yes. We do not even have that view in our modern society that women must positively consent before a man has sex with her. The rabbis are more modern, even, or what I would call, let's say, more feminist. To think of a Talmudic rabbi as feminist,
but which we should,
Of modern times. The way they treat rape victims was astonishingly way more liberal than nowadays. You talked about an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth in the Bible. The rabbis said that's not what that means. That you don't get to poke out somebody's eye if they poke out yours. What the Torah actually means, the rabbis say, is monetary damages. That you and they have a very famous section in Bava Kamma about a person who injures someone else. Doesn't matter if it's accident, doesn't matter if it's assault on purpose. They have to pay for healing, they have to pay for the doctor, they have to pay for the lost wages. If it's a permanent injury, there's a special compensation for that. They have her pain and suffering. And a woman who is raped is treated like any other assault victim. Her attacker pays lost wages, you know, all the same five things for any other. They don't say, what was she doing out at night? What was she wearing? There's no
question. Did she ask for it? Yeah.
That she asked for it.
Right.
This is assault, an injury, exactly the same as any other kind of injury that a person might cause another. A husband is not allowed to assault his wife. Should he do this to her? He pays for all of the usual damages. And if she wants to live separately from him, she can demand that. He's not allowed to divorce her. He must support her in a separate dwelling if she refuses to live with him after that. And I'm reading this, I'm going, this is amazing. You don't even get this in even
modern
very
society. Yeah.
Modern society, women are blamed for
right.
for somehow encouraging men you know, to
right.
rape them. And the rabbis did not even, they would not even go there. This is assault like any other assault. We do not blame the victim.
So maybe we need more Talmud in our lives. You know, our modern world is so caught between the polar extremes of everything being sex on every commercial and everything. And on the other hand, this hyper-conservatism of not talking about certain things in certain sectors. And maybe what we need to do, and maybe that's what Judaism continues to contribute to the world,
yes.
is to bring a little bit of, like, bring it back to the middle. It's not a, but it's also
yes.
not something... It should, women should be respected. That's what a lot of women keep asking for. And it's in the Jewish sources from what you consider an old-fashioned world. So maybe we need a little bit of that old-fashioned back into our world today to make things,
well,
you know, where they should be.
Well, certainly, okay, all of my Rashi's Daughters, the historical novels that I wrote, my goal, I had a slight political goal in getting more women and more liberal Jews to study Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
For so Talmud has been the monopoly of like old men in black coats because we didn't have translations other than the Aramaic. And who speaks it, you know, who reads
right.
Aramaic anymore? But
right.
now we have Steinsaltz, a great Hebrew one. We have good English one, translations. You know, there's no excuse. I can't study Talmud because I don't know Aramaic. And I think when I wrote this book, part of the mind was, okay, if I write a book about what the rabbis have to say about sex, if that doesn't make you want to study Talmud, then...
Nothing will.
You know, just give it up. And it, you know, as you know, it's short. The type is big. I just
yes.
give you 50 sections. You know, more. Actually, it's more than 50 sections if you look in the back. I just divided it into 50 categories.
Right.
And hopefully, people will see this that the Talmud is a lot more. It's not. Yes, it is legal. You know, obtuse.
Right.
Discussions, but sometimes those discussions are about sex. They're about things that are important to our lives.
That are real. Yes.
Real.
And
yes.
every day. Yeah.
The rabbis certainly had discussions about things that were not real. They used examples that they knew were imaginary just to try and work out the law. But a lot of the stuff was real. Or when they're trying to use imaginary situations to figure the law, eventually it will come down to having a answer for real life problems. And there are certainly rabbis who have problems with women. There are misogynistic rabbis, just like there's misogynistic
anybody,
men.
Yes.
But those are not the majority of the rabbis. The rabbis, for the most part, I found were far more, I was surprised at how respectful they were. I mean, I got into becoming an expert on sex in the Talmud kind of accidentally when I was writing the first Rashi's Daughters. There's a part of the Talmud is very adamant that the quality of a child is proportional to the sex act that conceives that child. The better the sex, the more pleasure for the man and the woman, the better the child that comes out of that cohabitation. And so... Since Yocheved and Meir, Yocheved being Rashi's oldest daughter, they had six children, four sons, two daughters that we know of. They may have had more daughters. But all four sons were great scholars,
yes.
two of them well-known, Rabbeinu Tam and Rashbam are authorities even today. Two of their daughters were learned. One of them wrote, we know about these learned daughters who wrote responsa. And so I thought, wow, Yocheved and Meir have six children that are exemplary scholars, any one of whom a Jewish couple would just be thrilled to have. So if they had these six, surely they had the hottest sex in the millennium. You know, in order to have six kids.
How do I
order,
think about them? Yeah.
You know, so, and, but
okay.
When you write a novel, they always teach you, show, don't tell. So, okay, if I have to write about Yocheved and Meir having sex, I need to find out what's halakha. I can't show them violating Jewish law.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had to like, well, okay, what was halakha in 11th century when they're doing it? And I saw, I'm like, you know, and of course I'm reading Talmud. And so I tried to find those parts of Talmud. And I was very surprised to find out that the rabbis have a pretty good discussion about how good, you know, not so much the good sex. Yes, they'd say good sex, good children. But then they go into bad sex leads to bad children. And they give you examples of what they consider bad sex. And it's not like the wrong position or the wrong kind of foreplay or any of that kind of stuff. It's the relationship between the parents. Like the husband forced the wife. She was afraid of him. They were thinking of other people. One of them had decided to divorce the other. One of them hated the other. Things that we think today, yes, if that's how the parents feel about each other, their children are not going to turn out to be such good people. The relationship in the family is going to be terrible. And I'm thinking, I'm doing this in the Talmud?
So, I mean, this reflects that idea of really Judaism combining the physical and the spiritual. They're not two separate spheres in our religion. They're very much combined in everything that we are. So Maggie Anton, this is a great book. Guys, I highly recommend this, although it's probably one of those books that you shouldn't read in the bathroom. I'm just saying. Okay, 50 Shades of Talmud, What the First Rabbis Had to Say About You Know What by Maggie Anton. Thank you so much, Maggie. I always love talking to you. And keep on writing.
It was a pleasure that we, you know, I'm in California and you're in Israel, and we managed to find a time that we can actually have this conversation.
Exactly, exactly. So thank you so much, and looking forward to your next work. And this one's great. I really appreciate you, for lack of a better term, exposing something about the Talmud that people might not have known, and maybe piquing some interest
for who knows what reasons. Okay, thank you so much. This has been Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation for the Land of Israel Network. You can write to me, eve@thelandofisrael.com. Many thanks, as usual, to Ben Bresky, my technician, for putting all this together. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.